Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which is at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. You know, I just realized that this particular show is not just about the future. It's about the present, the past, and everything else.
Well, we're going to start sort of talking about the future, but you're absolutely right. This gets into what's real, you know, what's existence all about. So there is more than just the future angle.
That's right. Matrix fans, hang on.
Yeah. Well, we did use the M word in promoting the show. So yeah, if anyone's listening because of the Matrix thing, that's coming later. But we will actually be getting into this. This tonight is part 7 of The World Transformed on Fast Forward Radio. We've been working all summer long through the major transformations that we see coming in the future, and tonight we're talking about virtual worlds and the future of human personality. What it means even to be human, and we'll be getting into that with a very distinguished panel, which we'll be bringing out in just a moment. But before we do, we need to say hello to Michael Darling, our chat host. Hey, Michael.
Dude.
How's it going, Michael?
We're going to be back from surf country, I take it.
I spent 8 days on the beach in near San Diego, hanging out with surfers and teaching my two boys to surf.
Outstanding. Well, that sounds like a great summer vacation, and we're glad to have you back. And you take that cowabunga attitude with you into the chat room and catch some tubular ones. I think is the,
right on, dude.
the expression there. We'll be referring to Michael as MD tonight because we have a Michael on our panel, so we'll try to avoid any confusion there. And Stephen, I think let's get this program going. Let's bring out our panel.
That's right. We have on the show for the first time, I believe, is Dr. Bruce Katz. He's a leading thinker and researcher in the field of artificial intelligence. He is the chief AI scientist at Cold Light Solutions, and he's the author of Nano Engineering, The Future, Virtual Minds, and the Creation of Immortality. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you. It's neuroengineering, actually. Not nano yet. We're not quite there yet.
Neuroengineering. Thank you. Neuroengineering the Future, Virtual Minds and the Creation of Immortality.
Glad to have you on the program, Bruce.
Thank you.
And we've also got Michael Anisimov with us, welcoming him back to Fast Forward Radio, a great friend of both this program and The Speculist. Michael is a science and technology writer and consultant. He's the creative force behind one of the leading futurist blogs, Accelerating Future. He's the co-founder of the Immortality Institute. He's the media director for the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. And in his spare time, the fundraising director for North America for the Lifeboat Foundation. And I just want to say that I've been blogging for, seven years I've been blogging, trying to put my name out there, and I've left one comment at Accelerating Future last week, and now I'm a household name. So Michael Anisimov is a powerful media figure. Michael, welcome back to the program.
Hey, guys.
glad to have you with us tonight.
We also have on the panel with us tonight is Greg Campbell. He's an Intel alumnus and a veteran of several Internet startups. He is an information technology consultant, a virtual worlds researcher, and contributing editor to H+ magazine. where he writes under the name Surf Daddy Orca, which, of course, we're going to have to call him Surf Daddy tonight. So
we got to go with that.
Yeah, we got to go with that. That's just too good. Recent articles related to the show's topic include a brain on a chip and games that design themselves. Welcome, Surf Daddy.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm headed down to San Diego myself next week to do a little surfing with my boys.
Awesome.
There you go. All right. Well, this is becoming the theme. I actually got back from San Diego today, but I was there over the weekend for a conference, and I didn't get that close to the water, unfortunately. So good for you guys keeping it real there with the surfing. All right. So we're going to jump into our two questions that we've been asking all the guests and panelists who've participated in the World Transformed to date. So those who've listened to some of the earlier programs, I guess, have a little bit of an advantage, but no fair cheating using somebody else's answer. And just to make sure we get some fresh answers, we'll mix it up here and start with Surf Daddy, and we'll say these two questions for you. One, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you've witnessed in your lifetime? And then two, what is the greatest transformation of our world that you expect to witness in your lifetime, if different from the previous answer?
Yeah, yeah. In some ways, I see those as sort of interrelated. I know a number of people on previous shows have commented that the internet is probably the biggest transformative event that they've lived through. I'm actually old enough to remember the moon landing, though, which I think was very transformative, perhaps in a little different way, giving us a perspective of the Earth from the moon and seeing footprints in the moon dust. And that's probably an engineering achievement akin to what the Spanish and Portuguese did 500 years ago in trying to sail across the ocean, and quite an achievement. But I guess I view the internet as kind of an evolutionary process, starting with networked Unix computers from 40 years ago, and then the gradual evolution through the homebrew computing club, the early Macintosh and PC, and then, of course, HTTP and URLs in the World Wide Web, which certainly is transformative. So I'm a little torn. The moon landing certainly was a big event for me. Going forward, I think hopefully not nuclear winter, but I sort of see William Gibson. I think of William Gibson's fiction, and of course, he talked about the Matrix in maybe a little different way than the Matrix was portrayed in the 1999 movie. As a, of course, sort of a graphic representation of data and a 3D space that one can move through just by thinking. And I see potentially moving forward that our virtual selves may be, in fact, living in something like that, which could be quite transformative as we move into neural prosthetics, 3D web, and, of course, molecular assemblers, nanotechnology.
You know what's interesting about both of those answers, if you take the Apollo 11, and, in fact, you can even go earlier than that to Apollo 8, where the first mission that actually circled the moon, that actually left Earth orbit and went into orbit around the moon and gave us that first ever view of the Earth as this little blue ball in space. It was a transformation of our understanding of our place in the universe, right, of our capability. And you think about, well, if we get to this place where we find that inevitably we conclude that the world is this computer simulation, it's this designed place, that would also likewise be this this astounding change in perception as to what the universe actually is. So, interesting theme you've got running through your two answers there.
Thank you.
Well, we need to throw out our questions to another guest. Working in reverse order, Michael, what's the greatest transformation of the world that you've witnessed, and what's the greatest transformation you expect to witness in your lifetime?
Well, let's see. The greatest one I've witnessed is pretty much the same as what other people have, which is the internet. But I just want to comment on it a little further there. I think it's interesting that so many people have been involved, and how the internet isn't only a medium for people communicating, but it also has started to leak into the real world with average, like, non-nerdy people, and especially in the last decade, where, especially with cell phones, you get people who won't even go out to, like, a nightclub or a bar or something without checking reviews of it online. I didn't think that would happen so quickly. I think it's kind of cool how this, like, abstractive web is stretching between, like, every person in the developed world, not the developing world quite yet, but the internet started to become available in a lot of really far out of the way places. Like, you can go to villages in India and find a cafe and not much else, you know. So I think it's cool how the internet is starting to intertwine with the real world, not just existing as an independent entity, which is what I thought of it more of in the 90s. And for the number one thing that I expect to see would be also to slightly recycle an answer would be greater than human intelligence, but to go also a little bit beyond that, because I thought about how I could spin in a way that would be more interesting, I'm interested in the notion of just any hands-off self-replicating factory, which could be biotech, it could be not biological whatsoever, but whatever it is, the first unit that can self-replicate and where we can program arbitrarily what the output is would be pretty much like kind of what, as far back as ancient Greeks, we've been waiting for, which is the notion of wealth without money, the notion of just things being produced without human input. And that might go more into the post-scarcity show next week, and I'm going to definitely listen to that, but I'd say, yeah, self-replicating factories would be the number one thing I'd like to witness or hope I would witness.
Well, that's a big one for sure. Absolutely, yeah. And it is interesting how the internet does recur as one of the popular answers. Although there have been a couple of other interesting takes on big changes. So
I'm glad you mentioned cell phones. I think Michael, that might have been the first mention of cell phones in this series.
I think so. Per se, yeah, absolutely. Good call. Yeah, and what a game changer they have been for sure. Bruce, what do you think? Biggest transformation you've seen, the biggest you expect to see?
Yeah, I'm going to give an answer which is a little bit different. I'm going to say moldy bread.
Yeah, that is different, okay.
Yes. Specific, not moldy bread per se, but something that can be derived from moldy bread. And it's, what I'm talking about is LSD. something that we produced, but we discovered by accident. Actually, Albert Hofmann discovered it in 1938, quite by accident. As far as I'm concerned, I think that was the beginning of something of a long-term trend, which is just beginning to take off right now, which is sometimes it goes by the name of bliss engineering, although we can generalize that to emotional engineering in general. So not just controlling our intellectual state, not just controlling what we can see, not just controlling what we can do in the world, but actually controlling how we feel about things. And I think that will ultimately prove to be the most significant transformation of mankind.
So the biggest one you've seen, and so you're giving the same answer for both questions? Which is perfectly allowed, I should say, in the structure of the question.
Right. The difference between the two answers is that I believe that through neural engineering, we're going to be able to have much more fine-grained control over our emotional and cognitive states. I mean, one of the things about LSD is that it's called acid, of course, and that's not by accident. It's very uncontrollable. It can erase the personality, for example. Sometimes the personality doesn't even come back completely.
Mm.
This is not the kind of thing we necessarily would desire in a future emotional engineering system. So I think what's going to happen in the future is that we're going to have much more fine-grained control, not just by manipulating single neurotransmitters or single systems within the brain, but precisely taking the brain to exactly where we wish it to go.
Right, so we're talking about this long process that began with this discovery of LSD,
exactly.
And the awareness that you can change your state, leading to this kind of end state where we have tremendous control over this and the ability, I guess, to achieve states we can't even really imagine now.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think we have to be very humble in this regard, in the regard that we we did not necessarily experience the full range of our emotions or what could possibly be experienced. We have fairly limited ranges depending on our environments, the way we interact with other people. Speaking of surfing, I've never been surfing. I know that if I had been surfing, then I would probably be experiencing something completely different, or at least somewhat different than what I normally experience. And so I think that's the ability to control that at the fine grain level is an important direction.
To be able to bottle the surfing experience, right? Take the surfing pill, as it were.
Almost.
Surfing high, and be able to associate it with tasks that might not be as pleasant.
Yeah, exactly. So just before we move on, a quick disclaimer, and I don't want anyone to have any misunderstanding that we've endorsed the use of LSD. Kids don't do drugs. Okay. Make sure we're completely clear on that. Okay, I think we're ready to jump into our topic for the evening. Stephen, you wanna give it a start?
Sure. I guess I'll just throw this out to the entire panel, you think that's cool, Phil? I'll just whoever wants to jump in on
answer,
it,
yeah, there you
yeah
go.
We'll just throw it out. Virtual worlds and electronic contexts. How do you define a virtual world, or even just a virtual experience? Is it something as simple as what we have presently, Second Life or World of Warcraft, or is it going to be something a little bit more with greater resolution? I'll just throw that out to the panel as a whole.
I'd call World of Warcraft virtual world, and I'd say that we've been making virtual worlds since Pong, probably.
All right.
So you'd include Facebook and other things as well, then. Pretty much the internet, I guess, is in a way
a
virtual world.
They take you out of your everyday experience, almost not quite to the same degree that LSD does, but they still take you out of everyday like experience as it was for thousands of years before into even chess is kind of like a virtual world, but it's more, it has a much stronger impact when it's on a screen.
It's interesting when you think about that. So Pong was a virtual game of ping pong. When the World Wide Web showed up, you have actually going back to the first graphical user interfaces, you have virtual windows, right, that are displaying information to you. So I can kind of see where you're going. How about others on the panel? Would you agree with Michael's take, or do you have a more I'm not going to say robust definition, but a firmer requirements for what is required of a virtual world, or can we say that, say, Facebook is a virtual world? Or my favorite would be, is Fast Forward Radio, is this a virtual world that we've created here? We've got a chat room where people are talking, and Stephen and I even say in the introduction that we're in a virtual radio studio together doing the show, although actually I'm in Colorado and he's in Louisiana. So are we creating a virtual world when we do this kind of thing?
Oh, well, this is Surf Daddy. Maybe to piggyback a little bit off of what Michael was saying, I think even a book, in a way, is creating a virtual space that that one can immerse themselves in, and lose their sense of everyday reality and identity, and assume another identity, perhaps the protagonist in a novel. As far as Second Life, which I'm fairly familiar with, World of Warcraft, it's really not. I would say it's a kind of embodiment, yes, and it can certainly fool the mind as a simulation of real life, and also help. I think residents in these types of quote unquote virtual worlds, electronic virtual worlds, experience a certain amount of corporeal immediacy as well.
Right. Yeah. They're carrying more of the real world into them, I guess, I guess greater complexity, greater depth or richness of the mirroring of the actual world experience in those kinds of worlds. Is that the difference?
Yes, and I think as far as virtuality of being in a virtual space, and I mean certainly we can go much further than that. I think certainly we'll probably get into that topic as well later on. But I think being able to immerse oneself in something that's other than the everyday experience, which indeed could be a simulation as well, is a possible definition.
Okay. So, Bruce, what do you think about all this? Is a book a virtual world, and by extension, is a daydream a virtual world? If I'm just kind of creating my own little reality around myself, or are those virtual worlds?
I'm not sure that we really have to say that this is a virtual world. That is not a virtual world. I'm not sure that we really have to define it.
Mm-hmm.
I think a more fundamental question is what you can do in those worlds.
Okay.
And certainly, right now we have limited resolution and limited capabilities in the virtual worlds that we create. Of course, that's going to change very quickly. But the other topic which I talk about a little bit in my book is the concept of lucid waking. So is everybody familiar with the concept of lucid dreaming, or should I define that?
You might want to take us through it real fast.
Okay, so lucid dreaming is when you're dreaming, and then suddenly in the dream you realize that you're dreaming. And then because it's your own dream, in principle, you have the capability to control what's going on, unlike in real life. So, for example, if I wanted to just fly out my window right now, I mean, I could jump out, but I wouldn't survive the fall. I'm on the third floor here. But if I was dreaming and I decided to, and I knew that I was dreaming, I woke up, so to speak, in my dream, then I would be able to do that. Now, it's very hard to do this in your dream and maintain a high-resolution experience, whether that be visual or emotional or otherwise. The concept of lucid waking would be existing in a virtual environment where you would actually be able to have a thought, I want to do X, fly, do something that you could ordinarily do, possibly that would conflict with the ordinary laws of physics, and be able to do that while you were awake and maintain the same sort of high resolution. And the feeling of being awake is different than being asleep. I mean, you have greater access to your sensory experiences. So that's the concept of lucid waking. And I think that's probably more important than saying a book is a virtual experience or is not a virtual experience, for example.
Okay. So I like the term lucid waking. It's the first time I heard that. I had heard of lucid dreaming before, but I like the fully conscious total control of what's happening in your environment kind of idea.
Of the lucid dreaming state, but into the waking state, possibly done with artificial virtual reality devices.
Okay. Well, now let's with these thoughts on virtual worlds in mind, say, or the ability to achieve lucid waking states in mind, and we'll completely put aside for now the question of whether the entire universe is itself a computer simulation, because we are going to address that later in the show. How much of our time today is spent in virtual worlds? Have we reached an inflection point? I would consider it an inflection point if people were interacting within some kind of virtual context, say 20% of the time. And I'm wondering, using the old Pareto 20-80-20, how long before that flips and people begin to spend 80% of their time in a virtual world? Michael, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that the tipping point for me, at least especially, could have been taken. Like, thinking back into my childhood and my teenage life, I'd say maybe, especially now, like more than 50% of my time is spent like looking at screens. And it's funny because there was actually an Onion article about that saying, like, amazing finding, we spend 90% of our time looking at glowing screens.
Those little illuminated and, rectangles, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, right, that one. So, I mean, it seems like we have already kind of been past that inflection point, but the difference is between like when you watch television, it's not you interacting with other people. So it's a virtual play, maybe, kind of like a one-way information conduit. And for it to be, I guess now we're getting into that defining virtual worlds thing, I would hesitate to describe television as a virtual world because it seems kind of, you know, you can't do anything to it except for change the channel, which is pretty boring. So, but I mean, I spend most of my time on the internet and typing, probably more than 50%, probably more than 70% even. So I think that transformation's already occurred as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, interesting. And then to Bruce's point, the real difference might be the depth of the experience. Actually, what we get
yeah,
to experience.
Well, I would concur with myself.
Yeah, Bruce agrees with himself. Good.
Doesn't always happen, actually. But no, I think I would agree that we have reached the inflection point because the experience, the online experience, which is our most ubiquitous virtual experience, is significant. It's meaningful to us. We have courtships, for example, online. We have a lot of emotionally significant experiences, and I think that's why we've passed the inflection point. It's not so much the amount of time, whether it's 20%, 50%, it's the fact that we have meaningful interactions, extremely meaningful interactions, in a virtual or semi-virtualized environment.
I think Bruce is anticipating our next question, Phil.
Yeah, it sounds like. Go ahead, Stephen.
Our question is, what would lead us to want to spend the majority of our time in a virtual world? I mean, why would we give all this up? I leave all my groupies here in this world and...
How about Surf Daddy? You take a crack at this one, since you like.
Yeah, we kind of left you out.
And I'm just, you know, I'm thinking that that's something that it's, you know, is that what it would take? Would you have to be able to get you 100% of the time, say, into the virtual world, or 80%, or you know, to actually have you live there rather than here? If that's a realistic way of framing the choice, would the surfing experience need to be going on?
That's a funny question. Actually, I have done virtual surfing in Second Life. I actually won a surf contest.
All right.
Believe it or not. Yeah, and it was a lot of fun, actually. I mean, certainly it's like gameplay, of course, but, you know, there was a certain amount of immersion and realism that was going on there. Not like I was feeling the water against my skin or thinking about my toes getting nibbled by sharks or something like that. Yeah, and going back, I guess going back a little bit in terms of the previous question, I do agree that a lot of us spend a lot of time at computers, and as part of my IT consulting, I have my day job where I'm doing things that are related to programming and so forth, and then in the evenings I'll be maybe on Twitter or Facebook or maybe in a space like Second Life or Sun's Wonderland or something like that, or Hypey High. I spent some time there, the Chinese virtual world too, and the experience is maybe different for me that way. In some ways, I can see the electronic media, spending a lot of time in email. It's in a way kind of a glorified post office, right? Getting a lot of information, or people using computers as basically accounting systems, right? So that's kind of the workaday world, and I'm not sure that necessarily is a virtual world. I mean, I think that is the real world of everyday trading and finance and that's the world that we have to survive in to keep our physical existences together. As far as spending time in a virtual world, what would be compelling? I think obviously having some physical disability, and I do have friends like that actually that pretty much spend all their time in Second Life because of physical disabilities, and that's their world. That's how they experience the world. I think of one person in particular that has never seen a beach, could never go surfing, has never been out of her room essentially, and her experience of the world is through a medium like Second Life.
So in a world like Second Life, where arguably it's a
far inferior experience from the standpoint of if you were to compare, the resolution of the world around us or the tactile sensations or so forth. You know, we would look at that and say, well, I'm not going to spend all my time there because it's just not as good, but it's so much incrementally better than what would be available to someone who was in that position before Second Life was available that becomes a de facto. You know, it's not even a choice. You'd say, yeah, of course I'll spend time in there. Then what's interesting about that is you also have people who spend all their time in World of Warcraft. They're not disabled. They've just that's become where they want to be. And I wonder, Bruce or Michael, what do you think about other things that will motivate people to move into virtual space? Is it a good idea for people to give up the quote unquote real world in favor of something that's essentially an illusion?
Well, so I can take this one, Michael here. I thought about this a decent amount. I think there are like three main milestones that will help push it forward just really quickly. The first milestone will be where physical activity is thoroughly involved in the experience, kind of like how on the Wii you have Wii Fit and stuff like that, where you actually get to move around. And I was really fortunate to write an article on augmented reality for the upcoming issue of H Plus magazine, and I pointed in that to the way that people have been using augmented reality to kind of bring virtual objects into the real world. Because if you're wearing glasses that display objects on them, then you're seeing those objects in the real world. The second one, another important milestone, I think, will be full immersion. And I think we're a lot closer to that than we think, because there are two real human senses that seem to channel most of the most important information, which are sight and touch. And we don't really quite have the full 360 sight thing going on, but we do have good graphics for screens, which are getting smaller and higher resolution. But the touch thing is still a ways off. I'd say probably 20 years. We are not close to having a haptic feedback suit, which I think would be like kind of the crux of this second milestone, being able to grab objects in the virtual world and actually have the feedback felt on them. And the third milestone would be realistic sex via a virtual channel of some sort, which depends on all the things that I just mentioned before, motion, all of that. So I think that once it's possible to have realistic feeling sex in the virtual world, that would kind of be like, the coming of age.
That's
going to
be a tipping point, I think. That's going to be a major tipping point for virtual world. I mean, honestly, that's got to be a major milestone, right? When that occurs, I think that's going to have a lot of people exploring that technology at that point, seriously. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off there, Michael. Let me finish your thought.
I pretty much like that was, I want to keep it short, but I worry actually if we reach that point, if we have the same problem that Japan does today, where there's insufficient actual reproduction and people are too focused on things outside of having real sex, like their career or having sex with a virtual avatar or something. But that's
there
not
you go.
Actually
well, yeah.
that huge of a risk, because I think people do like real sex too, and I don't think it's going to go away anytime soon.
It's going to have to. Well, it wasn't really a planned topic, but my guess is it's going to have to be pretty darn good before it actually snuffs out the real thing. I think before it becomes an actual ultimate replacement for the real thing. What do you think, Bruce? Other motivations for people to start channeling their lives into virtual worlds, or any potential downsides you see to that happening?
I don't necessarily see the downside, but I'm going to give a little bit more conservative East Coast answer for this question, balance out the the West Coast bias here. I think the fundamental things apply, whether we're in the virtual universe or whether we're in the actual universe. I think what really counts are relationships, whether we can develop deep and meaningful relationships in the virtual world, and also the other thing that's important is if we can truly experience other cultures and other ways of looking at things in the virtual universe. So all of these things are dependent upon the other inventions, such as haptic feedback and things like that. But it's also something in addition to those things. It's not just a question of increasing our sensory capacity within the virtual world. I think I think fundamentally human beings are social beings, and to the extent the virtual universe will be able to reproduce or even make those social interactions better, I mean, to some extent, of course, it's already happening on Facebook and things of that nature, but to the extent that those things will be better online or in the virtual universe, then that will be the real tipping point.
Okay, that balances the answers out very nicely there. A number of different takes on what might motivate people to move into virtual worlds, and I think we'll move. We're going to come back to the subject of virtual worlds, but we're going to move on to the idea of virtual versions of ourselves. But before we do that, MD, do we have any questions or comments from the chat room of relevance to the subject of virtual worlds?
Well, I'm going to speak for the chat room because that's, you know, what I do. I think the chat room is unanimous that none of us here have ever seen an avatar hot enough that we would want to, you know, and let's just leave it at that.
Interesting.
Past
okay.
that, we're on board, but we're tangential, so nothing I want to throw in.
Okay, fair enough. All right. Well, Hank, stick with us, chat room. We're gonna look for your input on the subject of virtual versions of yourself. So be thinking about your questions. Now, I want to start off this topic by using an analogy, or actually referencing something that I saw on TV. The previously what was called the Sci-Fi Network. I'm now going to pronounce it SIFI, I think, since they're spelling it. I don't know if anyone's seen that SYFY nonsense, but the SIFI Network. They've got a new pilot for a new show. It's a spinoff from Battlestar Galactica, and the show's called Caprica, and it's a prequel to Battlestar Galactica. And I think what we're going to get in this show is the story of how the Cylons came to exist and all that sort of thing. And so it's dealing with artificial intelligence, and it's dealing with some of these kinds of issues. Now, the idea in this initial pilot episode was very interesting. The idea was promoted that a world, this is a fictional other planet these people live on, and I mean, yeah, they're technologically at roughly the same level we're at, maybe a few years in advance of where we are, but what they've done is, what they're able to do in this show is through all the little bits and pieces of ourselves that we put up online through photos and videos and profile pages and avatars and chat sessions and blog entries and chat transcripts and, you know, just all these little different pieces of ourselves that a person has actually allowed for the creation of a facsimile of him or herself online. And in the story, this fictional story, the dead are essentially resurrected in virtual worlds by aggregating all the online data that they left behind when they died. Now, I don't think that today there's enough content specific to me online that would allow for the creation of a very convincing facsimile. But my question is that going to change? And if so, how? And if virtual versions of ourselves are going to begin to show up online, will it be through that aggregation of available data, or will it occur by some other means, do you think? And we'll start with Surf Daddy on that one.
Boy, that's interesting. Certainly not any time close. I mean, I know the research is going on with the Blue Brain Project right now. Where I think we've gotten to the point of maybe the complexity of a mouse's brain being able to simulate it on the IBM Blue Gene computer, roughly 8,000 neurons and X number of synapses. And I know they're working towards ultimately a computational capacity of about 36.8 petaflops, which is 1,000 trillion floating point operations, which would be a supercomputer capable of running a software simulation like that. I think people are going to want to, you know, if we get to the point where we actually can get that kind of a simulation your collection, your personality, your memories, are basically being simulated on a super, some sort of a we'll call it a medium or a matrix, if you will. You're going to want to have multiple versions, and of course that brings up the interesting question about versioning, and you may encounter multiple versions of yourself, alternates of yourself, which you know right now that in virtual worlds like Second Life, you get things called alts and multiple accounts. People, can kind of simulate that, but not in the sense of being seeing yourself or a version of yourself. Was that the direction you were going with that question? Or?
Very interesting, very interesting. Yeah. I was just thinking how horrible it would be to come out with the Vista version of yourself and then everybody still prefers the XP version, right? It would just be socially just horrible, wouldn't it, to have something like that happen? What do you think, Michael? Can we construe ourselves from incrementally the parts of ourselves that we put online over time, or will we achieve virtual facsimiles of ourselves by some other means?
I think that at some point it could be theoretically possible to kind of duplicate yourself in an avatar, I think there's a lot of creativity and uniqueness in the world. So I think that sometimes it might be that possibility is a little overstated. You have the ability to create a avatar of yourself. Well, number one, first of all, there already is you, yourself. So it would just be creating a duplicate of something that already exists. And secondly, I think that if you have the ability to create an avatar of that great detail, there might be more interest in generating new persons from like semi-random algorithms, because then you'd be introduced to a brand new personality. And maybe you could mix and match like certain capabilities or personality quirks from a variety of people. So I think that while the potential of creating like a coffee avatar seems kind of intriguing now, I think it's somewhat of a symptom of our lack of imagination that we've talked about that a little more than creating arbitrarily new entities and non-player characters or whatever you want to call them, just like virtual beings, basically.
Well, I guess the thing that's interesting about it is because the next question is Stephen gets to ask this one, so I won't go there. But we're working towards something here, and I guess I'm seeing this more capable avatar as being kind of a step towards something else. I wonder if the interesting thing there would be, I guess, if they start to take on a life of their own, then it's not just a facsimile of me anymore. It's this independent being who has some interesting history with me, but maybe if it got far enough into its own existence, wouldn't have any particular desire to associate itself with me. Might go off, like a child, right? Might go off and decide, well, I'm going to go do my own thing now and have my own life and goodbye, right? Assuming it achieved that level of sophistication. What do you think, Bruce? Do we ultimately create online versions of ourselves, or through bits and pieces, or does that happen by some other means?
Yeah, well, I hate to throw a virtual monkey wrench into the simulation here, but
please do.
But there's an extremely important question here, and the question is whether these beings that we're creating are going to be self-aware or conscious or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're not, then we're just creating effectively, even no matter how close a copy it is, we're creating a zombie version of ourselves that is a being that doesn't really feel anything. Now, the question of consciousness, of course, has not been solved. It's not even close to being solved. So there's a very important theoretical stumbling block here, and it could be a stumbling block not only to this but to the singularity and all sorts of other things. It's not. This is something that most likely, nobody knows what the answer to the problem of consciousness is, but it most likely is going to be come about through a flash of genius or some sort of creative insight, and that's something we can't predict. That could happen in 2045, but it could also happen in 2273. It's not something we can control. And unless we're actually creating conscious versions of ourselves, that we're just creating simulations. It's not really the same thing.
Well, okay, but I have to challenge that for a moment. If it behaves as though it it has feelings, wouldn't I be morally obligated to treat it as though it did, even because I don't even know you're conscious, right? I mean, you know what I'm saying? The only person I know for sure is conscious is me, right? How would we ever know for sure that that a being in a computer had achieved consciousness?
Yeah. Okay, well, this is really another show, but we wouldn't know necessarily, but if we had a good theoretical account of consciousness, we could say that some being that has some of the same properties that we have are also conscious. So the problem of other minds is not really the main stumbling block here. It's really the theoretical understanding of consciousness. And if we had a good theoretical understanding, we'd say, This mind or this brain is almost like my brain. It's got these properties. These are the properties of consciousness. Therefore, this thing is most likely conscious also. So we're not inferring consciousness from behavior. We're inferring it from the internal structure of the mind itself.
Okay.
All right. Very interesting. So so the idea is that at some point we will know it when we see it, and we would actually be able to say that is consciousness, you know, consciousness is occurring in that simulated virtual structure or electronic structure. Maybe it's actually a hardwired brain.
We're not going to know it when we see it from behavior. We're going to know it when we come to a good theoretical understanding of consciousness.
Oh, okay. Very interesting. Other thoughts on consciousness from other members of the other members of the panel? Is that
This is Surf Daddy. I agree with what Bruce is saying. I think he makes an excellent point. I mean, certainly we could have zombie versions that are not true simulations, and yes, the question of consciousness is you know goes back you know to the dawn of our own self awareness. However, that came about. It's a tricky problem.
Is it possible that we would see ambiguous situations where we're just not sure if a virtual entity is conscious or not, or could there be intermediate states between zombie and fully conscious?
Yeah. Well, that's okay.
Oh, okay. I'd just like to mention I agree with you guys, and I think that the space of creatures that claim to be conscious but in fact are not, or lead us to believe that they're conscious but in fact are not, might be much larger than the space of possible beings that are actually conscious. So it will be crucial for us to like pursue that theoretical understanding that Bruce is talking about. And partially toward that end, we invited David Chalmers, who's one of the world leaders on consciousness, to our Singularity Summit event, which is happening in a couple of months, to help like try to elucidate these questions. And we got him to talk about uploading, which is the first time that I'm aware that he will be talking on the subject, so I am thoroughly anticipating what he'll have to say on it.
Well, you know, we already have some experience with questionably conscious people, I think. I spoke with Phil once before his morning coffee.
Well, that's a good point, yeah.
Yeah, zombie Phil, it ain't pretty, I tell you.
Well, you know, it's funny, the word zombie is so off-putting. You know, when I was thinking of them as facsimiles or avatars, they seemed kind of fun and friendly, but as soon as you attach the Z word to them, I don't even want to have them around at all. I'm like, oh. Okay, let's go with the consciousness thing. Stephen, I think you have a question.
Yeah, well, let's say I'm not satisfied with just an avatar, and let's say that we want to know if it's objectively possible to have the experience where you move from this world, this life, into basically upload yourself. Is this theoretically foreseeable or possible? I mean, I guess I'll just throw this out to everybody.
But somebody has to answer, though.
Yeah.
Can we sum up the question shortly?
Okay. Well, I guess this is a question that's related in some ways to the transporter problem of Star Trek. I mean, do you make the trip? subjectively, and if you're uploading your personality, would that be even possible?
Yes.
Okay. All right. I'd hope for more discussion, but oh well.
Thanks for joining us on Fast Forward Radio.
Good night.
Yeah, well, so, but this is a non-trivial question, I think. What you're getting at, Stephen, is this idea of not just is it a perfect copy of me, a conscious copy, but am I there, right? That's the real question. Has Stephen himself moved into this other substrate, and he's actually in there having subjective experiences? It's a continuation of his own selfhood. Is that a natural extension of what we're talking about? Michael, I thought I heard you say yes, but perhaps you could elaborate.
Well, the reason why I'm being kind of snarky is that it's one of the like old good dead horses of the transhumanist and futurist movements and like discourses is going on and on about this. And I think that it really is kind of subjective how you define identity. For instance, Ray Kurzweil thinks that if he got enough data about his father, even though his father's dead, he could revive him in a way where that would actually be his father in his eyes. And
similar to what we were talking about before, the Caprica idea of taking enough little bits of information and making a facsimile of him, but actually a conscious facsimile that would really be his dad.
Yeah, and I think it just like basically comes down to a voting game in that case. Like some people might call that a real continuation of him, some people might not, and some people might not consider a digital instantiation of themselves to be them, so they won't go through that process. Others will. I think that there will be some consensus, but also a lot of disagreement. And until we actually have the technology to play around with it, we really won't know, and it'll be subject to things like movies presenting a certain view, or like the early experiments, whether they have like positive or negative connotations, or how they're covered by media and all sorts of stuff like that, and philosophical movements we can't imagine. So it's a complex question.
Okay. Others with thoughts on that? Bruce?
Yeah, I think one very important distinction is between a first-person view of identity and a third-person view of identity. And I favor the former for the following reason. It really doesn't matter how well you emulate another person, or if Ray Kurzweil thinks that his father is there. I think the important question is if his father thinks that he came back to life. Because if we're going to transfer ourselves or achieve immortality or digitize ourselves, what we really want is for us to believe that we're continuing, not for other people to believe. And so I think that's the proper way of looking at it theoretically, although I do concur with the yes answer. I think it is a deterministic answer. I think it is identity, both identity and consciousness are law-driven. It's just that we haven't quite discovered what the laws are. There is one thing that we can say for certain, though, at this point, which is that we do not need everything. So we do not need all of our memories. We do not need all of our emotions. We do not need all of our connections to the world. And the way we know that is because we're constantly losing neural cells, neurons in our brain, and we're constantly altering our experience through learning and other experiences. And somehow we still have the feeling of continuity with our old selves. So the real question then, if you look at it that way, is how much can we lose and still retain our identity? And again, I think that's a first-person question. In other words, can we convince ourselves, in effect, that we are still the same person that we were before we made the leap into whatever digital realm that we happen to be leaping into?
And how much of that has to do with, and is this even a factor, but how much of it has to do with the period of time that it takes and how incrementally it's done versus how radically a change occurs? It seems like Ben Goertzel was saying something about this, because I can look back, at my own life. I can look at myself when I was, say, 19 years old, and I have virtually nothing in common with that person, right? I mean, very, very little. I don't think he and I would even want to hang out, right? I don't think we would have an awful lot in common. But I still feel like I'm a continuation. It's still me, right? That I moved from one stage to another and arrived here. So Of course, that's talking about all stuff that's well within what we normally think of as the human experience. But would not the same principle apply to other things that we might lose and other things that we might take on, even beyond the changes that we typically experience in our lives?
That's correct. I mean, that's something that we can almost say at this point, although this is taking a little bit of more of a theoretical leap, we can say that there can't be any radical discontinuities. And in fact, I base my theory on the derivatives of your view of yourself as you look back in time and how smooth those derivatives are. But certainly, I could morph into Oprah or Regis Philbin or somebody like that. And as long as that morphing was slow enough, then I would not perceive myself as actually being another person. If I did go to bed tonight, and if I woke up tomorrow morning and I became Oprah, then I would be in trouble.
That'd be huge, yeah. Well, I have to say, I think it would just be a few steps from me to Regis Philbin. I don't think that would be that big of a thing at all. that would be a fairly smooth transition, actually. So, what do you think? What do you think, Surf Daddy? Are we moving ourselves into another substrate, or are we making really interesting copies who then are essentially derivative works of us, or is it actually us that ends up in there?
Well, I guess I'll go back to my comment from before that I think the computational substrate for something like that is still many years away. But I think Bruce made a good point about the fact that what is the sort of the subset of memories and experiences that would need to come across to represent you in that new substrate or medium? That's a real interesting question. And I tend to agree with that. You, Phil, that was saying that I probably wouldn't want to hang out with me back when I was 19 years old or whatever. That's a reasonable comment because I really was a different person then. It seems possible that you could have a continuum, a sort of a spectrum, if you will, of yourself at with various memories that would be at least a partial you, but would that person have the same perception of the world and on the other side, so to speak, in the new substrate? Very interesting question.
Okay. Well, actually, Bruce, in answering the previous question, you kind of anticipated the next question, which has to do with the use of the word immortality in the title of your book. And I want to explore this just a little bit further because I feel like what I heard you say in the distinction between first person and third person view of identity is kind of where I was going. My concern is this. So I've got this uploaded electronic version of me that's now immortal thanks to the resiliency of the substrate in which it inhabits the medium that it's in. But would it really be me, or to use the phrase I just used when talking to Surf Daddy, is that just a derivative work based on the original? It would think it was me, but will I be in there thinking that it's that it's me, right? That's the question that I can't quite seem to get my head around here. Will I be in the other substrate doing the thinking, or still out here unable to participate?
Yeah. Well, if you take a cognitive or a memory-based view of identity, then as long as that thing, number one, is conscious, because of course we don't want to produce a zombie version. As we already mentioned, and as long as it has enough of your identity stuff, how much it needs to have is an open question, then it would be you. The thing that would prevent that from happening is if what's known as some simple view of the self held. A simple view would be more akin to a traditional religious view in the sense that there's something special about you, and there's some sort of metaphysical bookkeeping which says, here's a person, here's Surf Daddy. And then when Surf Daddy was conceived, although I guess he wasn't conceived as Surf Daddy, he was conceived under a different name. But when he was conceived, at that point, God or somebody instills his soul into his body, and then when he dies, it's going to be taken away. If there's some sort of special essence of Surf Daddy, then that would not be possible. But as long as a cognitive view of identity holds, even if it's a first-person view, then it will be possible that it's you.
And I guess, you know, not to ask you to summarize your entire book, but how do I get from here into there, briefly?
Yeah, there's a number of different methods. I think the worst method is probably the one that I've seen the most, which is trying to do a synapse-by-synapse copy or a partial synapse copy. I think that'll be possible eventually, but it's going to be extremely difficult. I think the two other ways will be more likely. Number one, through emulation. So if we do an emulation in sufficient detail, and we have a conscious entity on the other end, and we're able to actually, a little bit more than an emulation, really, a sort of a scanning of your brain such that we bombard it with a canonical set of inputs, and then we got the outputs out from that, sort of a basis set of inputs, and then we recreate sort of your essence in that way through that kind of emulation technique. I think that would be one possibility. But actually, I think the most likely possibility will be what's known as gradual offloading. And that's when we start putting neuroprosthetic devices on for all sorts of reasons, to increase our memory, to increase our intelligence, to increase our emotional range. And when that happens, eventually, more of you will end up in the digital prosthetic realm than in your original brain. So that is, so you'll gradually offload from your original wetware into the new hardware, and at that point it will just be painless. You'll just already be in the digital realm. And of course, once you're in the digital realm, you could beam yourself off to any other place in the universe at the speed of light.
Okay, so it's like you becoming Oprah. It's an incremental process that you have to go through.
Right.
So, Michael, Surf Daddy, thoughts on that? Does that sound like the right approach, or would you take a different route to get there, or would you not want to make that trip?
I thought that was a good summary of like the three possible ways in which someone could transfer themselves to a computer substrate. I wanted to point out somewhat of a like odd idea, which is that even it was mentioned the notion of people who consider their selfhood to be associated with their actual physical instantiation as it is now, and have trouble with the idea of it being transferred over to electronic entities. Well, in a sufficiently far off future, maybe somewhere on the order of when full uploading would be possible, it could be theoretically possible to actually retain your brain and just become only your brain and spinal cord and be like levitated in a fluid or something and communicate with other people entirely via electrical signals, because that's what the brain is. And in that way, like kind of a matrixy thing, it could be even become so thorough that you traveled as a pattern throughout a gigantic super brain or something, or you even retained all the neurons, but you were plugged in directly with other brains and computer mediators that pass signals back and forth. So it's kind of like a weird Dr. Moreau type of vision, like on the surface, but people oftentimes advance the notion of non-biological intelligence is impossible, or you can't have smartness in a non-biological substrate. Well, it would actually be possible to retain the biological substrate and get that uploading experience, although it wouldn't be exactly the same because maybe there would be difficulty in file transfer or something. But, I mean, if neurons and their patterns really are what defines you, then you could theoretically instantiate that in different types of neurons without ever actually having yourself have your, you know, the computer or the underlying substrate of you be non-biological. And another comment that I had had to do with the notion of multiple selves, which is that maybe in the future when we have better emotional control over our own minds, we might actually see ourselves now as fragments of personalities, because humans seem so beholden to emotions and anger, passion, frustration that and also, for instance, use of alcohol, or in the morning you feel a little bit more hazy than in the evening sometimes, or vice versa for other people. So I think that in the future we might see us as the fragmented personality and the virtual self as a more unitary, orderly identity or selfhood.
Okay. Well, I think that's an excellent point, and it kind of hails back to Stephen's comment about my need for coffee in the morning. I want to spin this one over to you, Surf Daddy. Can you top the image of brains and spinal cords suspended in fluid, floating around, emitting signals? just sheer creepiness. I think Michael might take the day here today. What?
That's an interesting image. Well, I wanted to step back for a second. With Bruce's comment about neuroprosthetic devices and augmentation, certainly that's. That's a more gradual process, and I think Michael's comment about thought communication. I mean, the Army's actually looking. U.S. Army's looking into that now. Being able to capture the electrical activity of the brain and transmit it in the battlefield. I think that augmentation process, that gradual process, certainly. At a certain point, how much of your biological self has now become, prosthetic or a series of implants, basically then a simulation, versus let's say suddenly we have this computational substrate available to us and we're able to totally emulate or copy synapse by synapse, what's going on in our brains. Today, suddenly, let's say awaken in this new substrate where many things may be possible. I think of Vanilla Sky, for example, the movie with Tom Cruise, where he's not aware that he's in that type of a simulation. That seems a much more radical process, and again, that makes the assumption that the emulation or simulation at the other end is conscious, as Bruce said.
Okay, well, the reference to Vanilla Sky is a great segue to our next topic, which is actually the whole idea of being in a simulation and not knowing it. But before we go there, Michael, I just want to check in with you in the chat room. Any thoughts on virtual versions of ourselves, uploaded versions of ourselves? Any questions from the chatters or comments?
Yes, several, and it's... Well, let me just say this. The chat room, we can't time shift the chat room. So the discussion that gets going in the chat room is volatile and dynamic, and as soon as it's over, it's over. That said...
Fair enough.
Yeah, Kurzweil's dad is gone and never to return.
Okay, this is the consensus of the chat room?
It is, sadly.
Okay, all right. Well, if they voted, that's it. They have the last word on these issues, I suppose.
we do sort of have if the issue is continuity of self, we sort of have a group of people that have kind of gone through this. Sometimes when people have serious strokes or brain injuries, they lose that feeling of continuity with their former selves, and sometimes it's regained and sometimes not, and perhaps that deserves more study.
It's an interesting analogy. In fact, when these transitions that our panel is talking about are eventually made, that experience might actually lend a good deal of understanding towards what has to happen. Well, one question I saw in the chat room that I will respond to, Sally asked about, is immortality really possible? And I think I think you always have to use that term with an understanding that it can be defined in a lot of different ways. And what I always like to say is when I use the term, I'm not talking God immortal, I'm talking like Highlander immortal, okay? But hopefully without the required decapitations. Okay, so we're gonna move on from the subject of virtual versions of ourselves to the subject of whether we live in a simulation. We're going to talk about Nick Bostrom's simulation hypothesis. And Stephen, why don't you just kind of, I think we've talked about this on the program a couple times before, but just kind of step us through, remind us of what that is.
Well, Bostrom basically has stated that we're probably living in a simulation now. And basically, in order to believe that we're not living in a simulation, he has basically three things that you have to go along with. Am I saying that right, Phil?
Yeah, well, I think you're on the right track. He breaks it down into basically three possibilities. Here's he gives you three choices, and you say you got to pick one of these. One of the following statements is true. So either very few or no civilizations will reach a technological level capable of producing a simulated reality. Either that's true, or no civilization or virtually no civilization will get to that who gets to the point where they could do that, will do it for any number of reasons. And one reason he gives is that maybe that would be seen as a needless diversion of computational processing power for other tasks, or maybe there would be ethical considerations of holding entities captive in simulated realities or what have you. So either civilizations that come along can't do it, or when they come along they can do it but choose not to, or the third option is virtually any entity with our general set of experiences is already living in a simulation. So if it's happening, it's widespread, and there's a good chance, the most likely case is that we're living in a simulation. Those are the three options that Bostrom lays out. So I want to take a few minutes and explore that with the panel. And Michael, I want to start with you because I saw some interesting discussion about the doomsday argument, which I see is kind of similar over on Accelerating Future recently. And now this is the argument that says similarly that the human era must be very near the end because it sets out a few propositions, uses logic, and says therefore humanity must almost very very nearly be over. And there was some great discussion in your blog about how that's probably a very flawed argument because it confuses probability with indexicality. Now, do you think that a similar error could lie at the heart of the simulation hypothesis, or is Bostrom, do you think he's right?
Yeah, you actually stole some of the things I was going to explain, but
oh, sorry.
That's all right. There's an interesting similarity, and I was thinking about the very same thing as we were going over. A simple idea of the doomsday argument is that if you take the assumption that most of humans that have ever lived are alive today, and it's probable that we would have been born into what would be considered a typical observer situation, then it's likely that we live at the time when the population is the highest. I'm still not decided on whether or not that is a accurate argument. I agree with some of my commenters that said that maybe we live in a very unusual world. For instance, maybe there's another world, universe in the multiverse right next door where there are 7 trillion humans instead of 7 billion on the planet. And it might just be a brute fact of our indexicality, as a commenter put it, that we happen to be in the smaller world. So there's that possibility, but the explanation that I find somewhat more plausible, or that I find to have a little more strength, is the idea that a post-human civilization would be able to run ancestor simulations without making them conscious. So you'd be able to run ancestor simulations at sufficiently high resolution, and having in hand the theory that Bruce was talking about, which I do think that one day we will find, where we can point to one arrangement of atoms and say that is conscious, point to another and say that's not. I think that you'll be able to run a simulation that's close enough to conscious beings, but not quite the same thing, that you'll be able to get all the information that you wanted out of it. And in fact, it might not even be necessary to run ancestor simulations. I think that we underestimate the power of brute intelligence. I think that using abstract inference might be able to let post-human civilizations imagine different courses of human history without actually having to simulate them.
Okay. Let me take the same question then. Actually, let me just give you a simpler version of the same question, because having said all that, if you were a betting man, are we in a simulation or not?
No, because of the second reason that I mentioned.
Okay, fair enough, because there would probably be a better way of going about it and so forth. Okay, same question to you. Bruce, what do you make of Bostrom's argument?
Yeah, a couple things. I mean, my first reaction is that I think an alternative but related hypothesis is actually more interesting, which is that we're in a simulation, but not a simulation
that a future civilization or we're not in an ancestor civilization. We're in a civilization. We're in a simulation because that's the only way that the universe as a whole makes sense. But I think that's another issue, and I think you probably want to discuss that later. With respect to his argument, I think a lot of it just depends on the amount of time that's available. If we assume for the sake of argument that we're actually physical beings, and if we assume in agreement with that, the universe is roughly 12 billion years old, then and we assume a certain density of planets that can sustain life, et cetera, then it's very probable that we are not in an ancestor simulation because there's simply not enough planets that could simulate life and create an advanced civilization that would be able to create the technology in order to accomplish that. So I don't think there's a contradiction in the fact that we're living in a physical universe by virtue of his argument. I think the contradictions are elsewhere, as I alluded to at the start of my answer.
Okay, and we're down to our final 10 minutes here. So why don't you let's jump to why would the universe make more sense then, and what would that simulation be if not an ancestor simulation?
Okay, well, speaking of Chalmers, I mean he talks a lot about this sort of thing. I think there are at least three fundamental problems with the universe as a set of physical atoms or even quantum mechanical interactions. Number one, there's a problem with physics itself. Number two, there's a problem of consciousness, which we've already alluded to. And number three, there is a real problem of what I like to call the real theory of everything, or the ARTO, rather than what physicists call the theory of everything, which is just the integration of the four fundamental forces. Really what we have to do is integrate not only the four fundamental forces, but also account for qualitative states, i.e. conscious and phenomenal states. And we have to put all those things together. And I think, this is a very complicated matter, but I think all of those things put together casts a lot of doubt on the fact that this is actually a physical universe. Even if you start with some very, very basic questions like the nature of causality, for example, how does an electron know that it's in the presence of an electric field? Questions of this sort. And how can this be made sense of outside of a simulation? Or alternatively, even if we don't say it can't be made sense of, maybe we have a better theory of the universe as a whole as a simulation rather than as a set of physical objects.
I've often thought that at the quantum level, the quanta is basically the limits of the resolution of this simulation.
That's what Fredkin thinks, and that's what Wolfram thinks in a slightly modified form, in the form of cellular automata. That's exactly right.
Yeah,
but if it's not an advanced civilization running the simulation, who's running it?
Ah. One question is, does anybody have to be running it? Another possible answer is it's in the mind of God, and then you start getting into philosophical idealism, or at least some version of that.
Okay. All right. Very interesting. All right. So, Surf Daddy, what do you think about the simulation argument?
Well, I think Bruce raised some real interesting ways that we might prove that we are living in a simulation. I guess that would be my first comment is how would we know what would be the proof and to verify that. And I think in terms of the possibility of an ancestor simulation, I know there's been talk. Stephen Hawking and Kurzweil talks about this, using a black hole as a data storage or computing device. The notion of computronium, it's kind of a science fictiony sort of a thing. You see it in Charles Strauss's Accelerando, where you have a Coke can router, it's basically a set of individuals who are in a starcraft that's traveling towards Jupiter with a laser steering the craft, and it's a massive what's called computronium, right, which is this computational substrate, and these are all virtual people on board, and ultimately in that type of science fiction you have the universe itself transforming into a computational
computational substrate, which I guess in some senses is the mind of God, as Bruce would say, you know, gets or could be. In some sense, you could say then maybe everything has already happened, and you know, we are just simulations of this let's call it master brain you might say the thoughts within this brain or the simulations within this brain. So certainly it's an interesting argument, I don't know that it's a convincing proof, and I think it was David Chalmers who commented that maybe there's a 20% probability that the hypothesis might be correct, and again I guess I would look at it from going back to my initial comment. How would you go about proving that we're in a simulation? Giving the data that we have, the physical data or the data of physics, chemistry, biology, etc., and what would it take to provide that kind of a convincing argument?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. I don't know how you would ever know that you were in a simulation unless there were Easter eggs built into the simulation to tell you at some point.
It's not absolutely necessary that we prove it in a mathematical sense. It could just be an inference to the best hypothesis. Just simpler to explain the universe as a whole as a simulation rather than a collection of physical objects. So I'll give you a very concrete example. Let's say that assuming that the universe is a simulation, we can derive that the speed of light is what it is, which is not something that physics assumes certain fundamental concepts now. It doesn't derive these things. If we could take that assumption, say, what kind of simulation would be efficient to run? And in that kind of simulation, you also have, as a side effect, these fundamental constants, that would be very strong evidence that we are in a simulation. Not proof, but very strong evidence that we were.
Okay. So, and we might just reach a reasonable level of certainty. We might just say, well, it's the explanation that makes the most sense, and therefore
exactly.
we're gonna go with that. Okay. Well, I have one last thought on the simulation argument before we wrap up, just related to the second proposition there, the idea that civilizations don't go that route for various reasons. And here's one I'd like to toss out there. Assuming the many worlds hypothesis is true, what if civilizations reach a point where they're just about capable of creating these elaborate simulations, but they also find that they have some means of accessing or observing other universes? If you had that, there'd be no reason to run simulations, right? You would just observe what was actually going on out there in the other universes. It'd be a lot easier than having to recreate that, which, according to many worlds, should be out there somewhere anyway. Is that fair to say, or I don't know? Anyone have a response to that?
I don't think it would be a universe if you could communicate between them, or they wouldn't be separate universes. They would then become the same universe, because one of the most common definitions of a universe is a causally isolated region.
Ah, okay. Well, it was a thought. All right. Well, I'm trying. I'm trying to come up with some stuff here. Okay. So, Michael, MD, any parting shots from our friends in the chat room on the topic of the simulation hypothesis?
More complicated than I can summarize, because these guys, this chat group tonight was, I don't know, they should be decaf the rest of the evening, though. I couldn't keep up.
Take it down,
chatters.
You're wearing out our chat host here.
That's right. It was a great chat tonight. But one thing that Thuris or Thurls, I can't read if that's an I or an L, brought out was that in the simulation, it seems unlikely in that maintaining consistency across the simulation and therefore coherence to us would not happen. Of course, you postulate any kind of superintelligence you want to overcome that, but I think from a coherency point of view, it assumes that we'd have to be in a bubble. We couldn't actually be in the universe, because something random from the universe could interfere, and then it would throw off the coherency of the simulation. But like I said, it was beyond me, and it was good.
Okay, fair enough. Well, based on what Michael just told us about what a universe is, there's no place else to be but in the universe. So with that in mind, I guess we'd have no alternative. Okay, well, I'm going to thank our panel very much. Any parting shots, anything anyone wanted to say on any of these topics that you didn't get an opportunity to? I'll go round robin real fast. Michael, any parting thoughts on any of these topics?
Yeah. I just wanted to say I get the feeling that we're like kind of sort of like bugs examining like a civilization-sized like set of philosophical challenges here. And if our answers sound like big or stupid or just getting like the first scratching the surface, then they should be, because I think we'll actually need the technology to create arbitrary minds and run them in simulations before we have the answers to a lot of these questions.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, per my earlier comment, at least we're throwing something out there, right? We're giving it a shot. Surf Daddy, any parting comments on these topics?
Well, I think Michael kind of hit the nail on the head. It is a challenging set of problems, and I think we're just starting to look at them. I studied philosophy when I was younger, and certainly we did not look at these issues, at least in this light. I mean, I think some of these arguments you can see, in other periods, the early Greeks and during the Middle Ages and during the Renaissance. They're being reframed in a very interesting manner. I know I'm reading Dr. Katz, Bruce's book right now on Neuroengineering in the Future. He's got a philosophical bent himself, and it's fascinating reading. And then I know Ben Goertzel as well is another thinker that he definitely has thoughts on what you might call philosophy of mind, which I think we've touched on this evening. So I'd say stay tuned. There's going to be a lot more discussion on these topics.
Absolutely, absolutely. But we're giving it a try. We're getting a start. Okay, Bruce, you get the last word on the subject.
I just wanted to thank my descendants, if they're listening, who are running me in the ancestor simulation, replacing me in this period of time, because I really think this is very exciting, and I concur with everybody, what everybody else is saying. I don't think we could have had this conversation even 10 years ago. And certainly I did not have these conversations when I took philosophy as an undergraduate.
Yeah, these are new topics, and it's all part of what we've been trying to do here on The World Transformed. This whole series has been about ideas that I think when I look back to my days in college, I don't think any of these topics were really things that conceptually were even in your craziest dorm room bull sessions at midnight, you didn't get into a lot of this stuff. So it's great that we had such a terrific panel this evening, and I want to thank all three of you. Stephen, what's our music this evening?
The song is Lake of Silver Bells, and the band is Carbon Leaf.
Okay, Carbon Leaf playing Lake of Silver Bells. All right, well, thanks for queuing that up for us, and thanks once again to Michael Anisimov, Bruce Katz, and Surf Daddy for being on the program. MD, thanks to you and to everyone in the chat room, everyone listening live, and for those of you listening on MP3, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again next week with the World of Abundance, the End of Scarcity. So be sure and be with us then. Until then, live to see it.
From the balcony we ride the pine top swells, down from the old hotel on the lake of silver bells, and lose memory when you make alone decisions. Much left for giving in the year of living dangerously happy. just a dream, but something on the other end. Wake up.